From the American Academy of Dermatology, welcome to Dialogues in Dermatology. I'm Dr. Ben Stoff, Editor-in-Chief. Thanks for tuning in.
When you join Mayo Clinic's Dermatology Department, you're joining a team that's transforming dermatologic care for the better. Here, you're doing the work that not only makes our patients' lives better, you're doing the work that changes your life. Visit jobs.mayoclinic.org/dermatology to learn more.
Hi, my name is Vineet Mishra, and I'm a Mohs surgeon and a board-certified dermatologist. And I have the pleasure to interview Dr. Olson from Duke University. She is the director of the T-cell lymphoma clinic. And Dr. Olson, please give me some information about yourself and your practice.
Thanks. I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about cutaneous lymphoma today. This has been something I've been involved with since I was a resident in dermatology, started a clinic back at that time, and have been involved as president of the ISCL, which is the International Cutaneous Lymphoma Group, as well as the United States Cutaneous Lymphoma Consortium, and have been also involved in establishing new guidelines for the staging and the classification over many years, including having the FDA and the industry and academicians get together to work on this at a think tank meeting that we had some years ago. So it's a continuing process that we've been working on over the years, basically, to continue to refine and update and change the staging and classification as we learn more about the nuances and the separation of all these different types of cutaneous lymphoma.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for all your hard work. I feel like you're right. This is a work in progress, this entire field, as you try to refine things and better understand things. Can you tell us a little bit more about what are some of the changes to the classification? And can you tell us more about why this all came about?
So in terms of why there has been an update, I think that we have different techniques than we have had in the past, new advances in terms of the way that we look at clonality, for example, the immunophenotyping that may now be used to help separate out some of the types of cutaneous lymphoma, the ways that we use imaging. So this has been of primary importance, I think, for clinical trials, for both the new clinical trials that are coming out from pharmaceutical companies, as well as the investigator-initiated ones, to make sure that we are using the best methods to evaluate and stage and classify these patients and assess them during studies and in practice as well. So it's not over. I can point out some things that we are looking at currently, but I can also go over some of the things that we now feel should be part of practice.
Absolutely. If you don't mind, can you help to kind of discuss more about the specific modifications that were made and what the dermatologist should be aware of?
So I'm going to go back a little bit on that because I think that the publications on the staging and classification have been totally in the oncology literature. And it may be that some of the older things that are out there are not known now by dermatologists. For example, the staging and classification system that we use for mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome, which are the types of cutaneous lymphoma that most dermatologists, I think, are familiar with. The non-MF, non-Sézary syndrome patients are staged in a completely different way. And that might not be obvious to everyone. So the T staging for mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome is based on the type of lesion and the percentage body surface area if the lesions are patches and plaques. The skin or T staging for the non-MF, non-Sézary, is based on the size of the lesions and where they are located relative to lymph node groups. So you would need a reference to know how the body is divided in terms of the lymph node groups in order to be able to determine that kind of staging. And we have a publication several years ago of a body surface area with those nodal groups. And we have updated that in our new publication. There have been some modifications to that, some corrections, if you would. So that's an important reference for a dermatologist to know when they're seeing patients, for example, who might have a marginal zone lymphoma in their clinic or a cutaneous anaplastic lymphoma in their clinic. So that part is important to know, that the T staging is different and that we made some modifications for the non-MF types of cutaneous lymphoma.
I see, because I was looking at the table specifically, and it states that for the T staging, so if it's MF kind or a Sézary syndrome, then if it's T1, it's less than 10% body surface area. If it's T2, then it's more than 10%. Is that correct? And then T3 is if the tumors are greater than 1 centimeter in diameter. Is that all accurate?
That's accurate, yes.
Okay. And then T4 is when you have over 80% BSA, where you have the confluence of the erythema. Now, specifically with the non-MF Sézary syndrome for T1, T2, and T3, can you talk more about that specifically, please?
So again, the lesion size will determine part of the T score. So whether the lesions are less than 5 centimeters in diameter or they're greater than 5 centimeters in diameter for the T1. And then when you get into the T2, it depends on whether, given a larger size, if it's less than 15 centimeters diameter circular area or 15 to less than 30 centimeters in the area. But it also is tracking back to whether the lesions are limited to one body region or two contiguous body regions. So again, very different than with MF, which it doesn't matter at all where the location is or the particular size for staging of the skin for mycosis fungoides. And then for the T3, for the more advanced stage for the non-MF, it would be multiple lesions involving two non-contiguous body regions, or the second classification for that, for those involving more than three or more body regions. And I don't think anyone's going to remember any of this by just me mentioning this. I think a table is helpful, and that is part of the publication. And also having the figure that shows you the different nodal groups. So there are some aids that are needed to establish the staging for these non-MF patients. And the thing is, we have very few treatments specifically and very few clinical trials that have looked at these non-MF patients. And I think primarily it's because we really didn't have a focus on the staging and classification for them. You know, most of the treatments that are available for cutaneous lymphoma are those related to mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome. And the cutaneous anaplastic lymphomas, for example, are primarily based on the treatments that we use for the MF and Sézary syndrome, or on the nodal anaplastic lymphoma patient. So that, I think, is an important part of knowing about the staging and classification systems. And this is only some modification from the previous publication on this some years ago, but some nuances that may make a big difference.
Just a quick question. What do you mean by a non-contiguous body region? How are you defining a body region exactly?
So that is, again, based on that lymph node areas of the body. So the upper arm is necessarily different than the chest, for example, but they are contiguous. So the lower arm would not be contiguous with the way this is with the chest, because there is an area in between that of the upper arm, for example. So it does require reviewing the figure for this.
I see. Yeah, because that figure is figure one in the letter, I believe, that you have submitted, which is very clearly indicated. And is this anything that's different from beforehand, or is this still the standard drainage patterns? That hasn't changed, right, specifically?
The drainage patterns were redrawn according to the classification that we had used. And so they are slightly different than before.
Got it. Okay. Perfect. And then when is there a role for further, I guess, imaging and blood tests and so forth? How does that figure in to the workup for the patient?
So I think the first part that we wanted to emphasize is to encourage the biopsy first, different types of lesions that might be present in a given patient, so that would enable not only the diagnosis, but sometimes it enables the separation from different types of cutaneous lymphoma. So for example, if there is a papular eruption as well as patches and plaques, for example, this could be a patient with mycosis fungoides who also has a type of LYP or lymphomatory papulosis, because those two can occur together. Or it could be a patient who presents with tumors and a plaque. And if you just biopsy the tumor, you might not be able to separate out a patient who has anaplastic lymphoma versus, say, mycosis fungoides with large cell transformation. Looking at the patch that might be also present, you might be able to see, oh, well, this is something that is more in line with a patient with mycosis fungoides, because these are typical other changes of mycosis fungoides. Or to take a biopsy of a typical plaque and something else that looks like alopecia. So you can tell whether this patient who has mycosis fungoides also has follicular tropism, which would be a prognostic factor for the patient. So first of all, knowing what to biopsy, how many to biopsy, that's a key part for separation of all these types of cutaneous lymphoma. And then I think the workup in terms of after you have the pathologic diagnosis, the workup of simple blood work is very similar, except that we now for the mycosis fungoides would also do as part of the workup an HTLV-1-2, because there is a certain population of patients that might look like mycosis fungoides, but actually have adult T-cell leukemia lymphoma, which can be something that comes up from patients who have spent time in Japan or in the Caribbean, or we see this now just southeastern US. So trying to sort out some of the prognostic factors and separate some of the entities by the blood work and the biopsies is important.
And specifically when you do the biopsies, are we doing just a 4 millimeter punch biopsy? Are we recommending something larger? I'm assuming it's a punch, right? They're using for biopsies.
So even that, it's such an interesting question that some people would do a shave biopsy. I think the problem with a shave biopsy is, yes, you get a bigger sample perhaps, but you don't have the depth that I think is important to look at. You know, you want to be able to look at the full dermis, for example. And in many cases, certainly if it's a plaque, you want to see if it actually is deeper into the subcutaneous. So I think a punch is the way to go. I don't think you need more than a 4 millimeter punch necessarily, unless you're planning to do a number of studies on that 4 millimeter punch. What I generally do, and I think many places do, is to do the 4 millimeter punch for the H&E and for the immunophenotyping, and then do a second biopsy for the clonality testing and collect the H&E immunophenotyping in formalin and then collect the clonality in saline. So because you will have a better chance of getting a positive test from clonality on the saline tissue versus the formalin fixed tissue. And also what happens, there's always a delay. If you choose to do the clonality on the formalin fixed, the pathologist is going to finish their diagnostic work first, and then with the tissue that's left, they'll do the clonality testing. So there can be a time delay in that also, whereas if you do them both together, I think it facilitates expediting this.
I see. Okay, that's really interesting. So if I have different morphologies, such as you said, patch versus plaque versus a site that has lack of hair, each of those sites should be biopsied so that we can make sure we capture the correct diagnosis or combination of diagnoses. Is that correct?
I think, yes, in a sense. I want to clarify that. You always want to take your biopsy primarily of the most infiltrated lesion. That's right. The first thing. But then for some of these other characteristics, I think if there are various types of lesions, yes, you would want to look at those, both because it might help to formalize the diagnosis, and also you might be able to find some different prognostic factors. So I would say that typically it's going to be one biopsy, maybe one for the diagnosis and one for clonality. But in looking at a patient, it's important to ascertain if they have various types and consider which ones might have some implications for the changing or modifying the diagnosis and or changing the prognosis of the patient or treatment. And I say that because if someone has follicular tropism, the topical medications are not going to penetrate necessarily. And the narrowband UVB that might be used is not going to penetrate deep enough. So a patient who has follicular tropism may need to have a different kind of therapy than someone who has patch disease also, but doesn't have that.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Absolutely. And then I was reading about the viscera and the bone marrow biopsy. When is that normally indicated in specifically which situations?
So I think I had mentioned that there are some items or issues about the staging that we still need to sort out. And I think the bone marrow biopsy is one of those. There's some changing ideas about who should get a bone marrow biopsy in some of the, I would say, indolent types of cutaneous B-cell lymphoma, like the marginal zone and the follicular center cell. But taking that aside, I think that will be decided by committee organization what is important. On the side of the mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome, there has not been any consistent direction on who should be getting this. We do recommend that if someone has hematologic abnormalities that you cannot otherwise explain, and that is not including an abnormal flow cytometry. That's including, for example, if they're very anemic and it's not clear why, or if they have an abnormally high white count that might not on flow cytometry look like mycosis fungoides. That would be an indication to do a bone marrow biopsy. And to clarify on that, I have some patients who come in with an elevated white count, and they may have CLL in addition to their mycosis fungoides. So what you find on flow when you're looking for it, thinking that it might be Sézary, might turn out to be something else. But people who do the bone marrow biopsy in a patient who they're evaluating their presumed Sézary syndrome because they have elevated abnormal numbers of aberrant lymphocytes that are identified by either looking at a Sézary cell prep or by flow cytometry, if they do a bone marrow biopsy and it is positive, but the rest of the evaluation for visceral disease by imaging, for example, is negative, we have subcategorized the visceral classification for those patients who have MF so that we separate out if it's bone marrow only versus other involvement, such as liver or spleen, which would be the other typical areas for visceral involvement.
Okay, perfect. What other highlights do you feel that the listener needs to understand about specifically your letter and the whole kind of direction that we're moving in with the revamp?
Lymph nodes are a very important part of evaluation. The guidelines don't specifically say for clinical practice, if someone comes in with a few lesions, maybe 1%, 2% involvement, that they need to have any kind of imaging. But I will tell you that there are many patients that come in and you cannot confidently evaluate their lymph nodes by physical exam, either because of their habitus or size, you know, obesity. So imaging can be important if for early stage disease to make them feel confident that it is not and they don't have any extracutaneous disease, or for the physician to feel confident that they haven't missed something. Because lymph node involvement changes things. Even the presence of an abnormal or elevated or enlarged size of lymph node, one of them, would change the classification to a stage two, just having an enlarged one. And now we classify the size of an abnormal lymph node as at least 1.5 centimeters in the long diameter. Lymph nodes are like, they're not round. They're kind of in a bean shape. And so you want to look at the long diameter. And that is what we fall in line with the Lugano classification for lymphomas, to have that being the important size. And so it's difficult on physical exam to determine that. Certainly when you have imaging, you can determine that. And that would be the size also that you would determine needs to be biopsied. So two key components of lymph node assessment would be the imaging study, and then the type of biopsy. And we have two types of imaging that could be done unless someone had contrast problem, which they might go to MRI, but typically it's PET CT or CT scan for imaging. And I think in the past, most of the time for MF and Sézary syndrome, we were using CT, and it's still perfectly fine to do CT chest, abdomen, and pelvis. We also would recommend neck to be included in that. And that is usually a separate little type of order that you have to make when you add the neck to it. But the other thing is the PET CT, and we are encouraging the use of PET CT because it will help to direct the biopsy of a lymph node from some of the characteristics that you find, not only size, but the other parts of the PET exam. And then the other part is in terms of the biopsy itself, we would highly recommend not using an FNA to determine a biopsy for either type, not the MF cesarean or the non-MF non-cesarean, but instead at the minimum to use a core biopsy, and a core biopsy that would be enough to give you the H&E characteristics, immunophenotyping, and clonality, in which case you might have to do more than one. For mycosis fungoides and cesarean syndrome, the problem is that we are currently still classifying the lymph node based on the pathology. And the architecture is what primarily drives the pathologic assessment and staging from dermatopathic all the way to frank lymphoma. And sometimes you cannot get that from a core biopsy. So people obviously don't want to use an excisional biopsy on an internal type of node, but on the peripheral nodes, it might be a way to go first and then move to the excisional if there's a problem, or to go straight to the excisional again with the mycosis fungoides patients in particular. So the imaging, if you can do it, PET CT would be preferred at this point to gather more information in all the patients. And it certainly is recommended for the non-MF patients to use PET CT. There is one type of patient that's a marginal zone, one type of lymphoma that actually it's not PET avid. So using CT scanning for that type of tumor would be preferred. But in other cases, a PET CT, giving more information, making sure that the radiologist gives information on the long diameter, not the short diameter, which is something that sometimes I have to call about, and then deciding about the type of biopsy. I'm not thinking that dermatologists are necessarily going to go into the type of biopsy, but I do think that the imaging is something that the dermatologist needs to know about in their evaluation of these patients. And there's no reason that they can't do the full evaluation on these patients that they are seeing. They can get this done. Ideally, they would then be able to work with a quote unquote, a center of excellence that is able to treat the patient in all different types of ways, radiologically, oncologically, and with dermatologic medications or treatments that we have. But in many cases, people are out there, they don't have that option. So it's really important for the dermatologist to be aware of all these different aspects. Dermatologists are the first physicians to see these patients. You're going to be the ones to make the diagnosis, and you're going to be the ones to tell the patient primarily what they have. So it's important to be aware of some of these nuances in terms of the staging. You might be able to share with them how this is worked up as a standard and be able to confidently give the patient some directions on where they're going to go with this.
Absolutely. This is beyond helpful of helping me understand kind of the nuances of the CTCL world and kind of some of the ways to approach a patient and have a better understanding of why we're doing certain things. And I feel like this is very informative. So I recommend all the listeners to really dive deeper into this topic because I agree. I mean, I feel like dermatologists are, you know, sometimes we're at the forefront of this and we should be the one to help to diagnose and help to manage and guide the patient because they look to us as being experts. And of course, it's skin-based. So absolutely, absolutely. So thank you so much for that. I know we're almost towards the end of our interview time. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that we have not yet discussed or any final thoughts or comments?
Well, we didn't discuss blood, and I'm not sure if we have time to get into that, but certainly we have moved away from doing cesarean cell preps, which is a very subjective way of determining abnormality of cells, and it varies so much between pathologists in terms of what they call a cesarean cell. So I think that certainly we have moved to flow cytometry, and there are certain markers that we look to be indicative of abnormality and something that you could track for patients who have blood involvement, the CD4 positive, 26 negative, or CD4 positive, 7 negative cells. That also is an area of research to determine if there are other markers, other combinations that we should be looking at. Not all patients will have those markers, but still have an abnormal number of aberrant lymphocytes on flow. They're not those in particular. So I don't think we can necessarily limit it to that. And then also we do look at the blood clonality, and the blood clonality is important only really if it matches the skin clonality, which is another reason to get the skin clonality performed. Because as you get older, one can get multiple different small clones, and they are not all malignant. So you might have a clone that is different from the skin, and patients are wondering, what does that mean? Do I have a different cancer? I think it's important to understand that aspect as well. And sometimes it's also very difficult to assess whether they have a lot of blood involvement when someone is lymphopenic. We see that too. Some patients come in, they have a low white blood cell to begin with, they have a low lymphocyte count. And some of this, our recommendations using an absolute count of abnormal cells doesn't work for them. So there's another aspect that can be the percentage that we use of abnormal cells for those patients. So another whole category, only germane to the mycosis fungoides and Sézary, because the other types of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma do not have blood involvement, other than this AT, the adult T-cell leukemia lymphoma, which you're screening for when you get your HTLV-1-2.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you said that the Sézary cell count and that the CD4, CD8 ratios are no longer recommended to determine the specific blood classification, but more so it's the absolute number of the aberrant lymphocytes through flow cytometry now that is perceived to be now the gold standard, I guess, or the recommendation.
I think one of the things that knowing more about the staging and classification for these different types of cutaneous lymphoma, one of the major advantages is to understand the reports from clinical trials on the outcome. So typically, they will be reporting how patients do who have nodal disease, patients who have blood disease, patients who are skin only. And you'll be able to understand more, I think, about whether a given treatment is able to cover all of those silos of involvement in a lymphoma, or are they mostly helpful for one particular stage or type of or classification of lymphoma? And I think if you look at some of the systemic agents that have been approved in recent years, you can definitely see where some of them predict that they are going to be great agents for patients who have nodal disease. They're going to be great agents for patients who have blood involvement, but they might not do well for all of them. So I think that's another part of the classification, to look at how the patients were classified for that particular study. How did they do this? The whole methods. And this is why we've come out with these guidelines that will help to standardize the methods that are used in clinical trials for these particular cutaneous lymphomas.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for helping to kind of walk through the updates and the classification, how to evaluate a patient, the importance of imaging, lymph nodes, blood testing. I feel like we can go on and really discuss a lot more if we had more time. And I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us, and would urge the listeners to pull up the article and read it and read the letter. I think that the point that Dr. Olson brought up, that as dermatologists at the forefront, we are the experts, I think rings very true. And I think we need to serve our patients to the best of our ability and give them that reassurance that we can help to manage their condition. So thank you for your time. And I really appreciate all the hard work that you and your colleagues have put into this work. So thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
When you join Mayo Clinic's dermatology department, you're joining a team that's transforming dermatologic care for the better. Here, you're doing the work that not only makes our patients' lives better, you're doing the work that changes your life. Visit jobs.mayoclinic.org/dermatology to learn more.
Thanks again for tuning in to another edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. For more dialogues, subscribe to us through the website of the American Academy of Dermatology, then link your subscription through your favorite podcast app. Remember, the subscription is free for residents. New podcasts are released each week in addition to free special bonus episodes. You can also listen to Dialogues online through the AAD website. Thanks again for listening.